The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hello, welcome to another edition of the Agile Uprising Podcast. I'm your host, Andy Clef, and I'm pleased to welcome Andy Fleming to our show. Welcome, sir.
Delighted to be with you, Andy. Looking forward to the conversation.
This is the Andy and Andy show. We had one a couple of weeks ago with Jeff and Jeff. So Andy's CEO and founding principal at an organization called Way to Grow, also a co-author of An Everyone Culture, Becoming a Deliberately Developmental Organization. And that's a mouthful, and we're going to unpack that. I'm going to save my tongue and call it a DDO, Deliberately Developmental Organizations. These are, I loved reading the book and learning about these kinds of organizations that I think, unfortunately, are unusual, ones that tolerate, even prefer, making one's failures, risks, weaknesses visible, public, so that colleagues can really support each other. The opposite of that, so many are familiar with, the Tayloristic version, where everybody is doing, as the book says, a second job of hiding their weaknesses, trying to look their best, manage their impressions. Some of our listeners will be familiar with our previous podcast, Red is Good, where we talked about that concept of delivering watermelons, where it's nice and green on the outside, and when you crack it open, that's red on the inside. So listeners, imagine creating a workplace safe enough and demanding enough that everybody comes out of hiding. That's the promise of a DDO, and that's going to be the focus of our show. Before we dive in, Andy, tell us a little bit about your background, a little bit about Way to Grow's vision.
Sure. So I've been in the organizational development, leadership development field for about 30 years, and both inside of companies and also, but mostly as a consultant and executive coach, and have written a couple of books on life and career choices, and then collaborated with my colleagues for An Everyone Culture. Education-wise, I'm reminded of a story. The coach was told by a player at the toward the end of the season. He said, Coach, you know, I haven't missed a practice all year, expecting the coach to say, you know, something nice and flowery. And the coach reply was, well, you should be a lot further along than you are now. And so Andy, I went to Yale undergraduate and then Harvard Business School, and I've had the privilege of working with current colleagues Bob Keegan, Lisa Leahy, as well as Claire Lee, who's also a developmental coach and happens to be my spouse. I have worked with some others in the field of human development and organizational development. Some both luminaries as well as some folks who aren't widely known, but probably should be. I've been sort of chasing after this big idea that has crystallized with our book In Everyone Culture, chasing after it for a long time. And the idea is that you can create organizations, and in fact, we found some, and they do exist, where everyone grows. Where in the course of being a part of the organization, they can become and are expected to become better and fuller versions of themselves. And so our vision is to help stimulate the creation of, help further the creation of a million DDOs in the world. So that anybody who is looking to go to work in an organization that is not only successful from a business standpoint, but is also going to help them grow and help them move toward their full potential, can find one. And that's a personal thing for me in having two kids who are in their mid-teens and wanting them to be able to find organizations, work organizations, and heck, schools and other kinds of institutions that operate this way.
We embrace them for how they are. The entire, you know, part of the book talks about bringing our whole self to work.
That's right.
And I think we want that for our kids, we want that for our colleagues, and we want it for ourselves.
Absolutely.
So I want to start because the title seems so simple, yet it is so rich. And you touched on a little bit. We talk, you know, everyone culture. I want to talk about what do we mean by everybody? Is it just the underlings or just the leaders?
No, it's both, as you know, Andy. If you think about our paradigm that sort of began to emerge in the late 20th century for growing people at work, the paradigm that emerged was that the best thing to do was to identify a small percentage of your workforce who you would consider to be the quote-unquote high potentials.
Right, became part of the succession plan.
That's right. That's right. And it's kind of still for most companies or many companies, it's kind of the dominant paradigm. It's really sort of the talent management playbook, if you will, is to identify the high potentials and then create some special events, workshops, executive coaching, even some special experiences that exist outside of the regular flow of work. That are kind of extras or add-ons. And what we began to see and then did a deep dive into in our book is that there's what we would call now a 21st century paradigm that takes on the question of who you're going to develop. It says not just high potentials, you're going to develop everyone.
At every level.
At every level. And it includes the C-suite and it includes frontline folks and everybody in between. So that's what we mean by everyone.
The next part, culture. So we all embrace a healthy culture as agileists. We talk about culture, eat strategy for breakfast. A good, healthy culture increases everything, employee retention, profitability, better communication. It reduces cost structures. What are some of the other things that you guys stress with this concept of a healthy culture?
So from our perspective, a healthy culture has all of the things that you just mentioned, that it employee retention, profitability, greater frankness in communication, all those kinds of things. And it's also what we call a growth culture. That the culture fosters the development of every person in it. And that kind of baked into the culture itself is an expectation that people are going to stretch and grow. And that the people, when they come to work in that organization, can come into the organization knowing and expecting that they're going to be both challenged and supported as far as their own growth. And when you have a culture where people are stretching and growing, then you've got a culture that's better able to handle adaptive challenges that are the kind of challenges, you know, that organizations are facing, more and more, the more complex, ambiguous kind of problems that people who are in have kind of a growth mindset, if you will, and from our perspective, a growth culture is how you scale Carol Dweck's growth mindset idea. But people coming into such an organization, both individually and collectively, are going to be better equipped and in fact going to look forward to taking on the more complex problems and challenges. They're going to see that as part of their own growth journey, as opposed to, oh God, here's one more thing, the next thing that we've got to handle or somehow deal with. So hope gives a little bit of a sense of what we mean by an everyone culture. From our perspective, an everyone culture is really a growth culture.
And it also begins to touch on deliberate and development. So you talk about it is an expectation of everyone. It is upfront. It's known when you join this sort of team, this sort of culture. It's no surprise. It's a deliberate choice by policy, by practice, by principles, by value. And you also talked about development, not of a select few, and not of just a career. Let's unpack the DDO part of
it. Right. So deliberately is what we like to say is what takes someone's growth from what we would call happy accidents to something that happens much more intentionally, much more purposefully. Let me pack the unhappy accident idea for just a second. So if we, and we've done this in with thousands of folks in workshops, if you were to ask someone to talk about a time in their career that, you know, a 2-month period, a 6-month period that for whatever reason was a particularly growthful, a time of high growth for them, most everybody can come up with something after just a little bit of reflection. They can think about the project, you know, that they got put on unexpectedly, or an opportunity that came their way because somebody left and they were next in line, or they had somebody who believed in them and gave them a chance to do something that they'd never done before. Those kinds of experiences. And so everybody has those kind of stories. And if you unpack it a little bit, you see, my goodness, those were times when I really grew. And that growth that I experienced during that time, man, that enabled me to do things in my career and in my life that I wouldn't have been otherwise able to do. You know, thank goodness I had that experience. Well, yeah. But for most of us, in fact, almost all of us, those experiences are things that just kind of happened. We just sort of fell into it. But if you unpack it a little bit, you can see that there's common circumstances and common factors that enable growth experiences. And they have to do, in primarily speaking, with higher levels of challenge. So an opportunity to step outside of your comfort zone and what it is that you've done so far, or what it is that you might consider your particular strength, and also higher levels of support, that you at least had one person or maybe a group of people who believed in you, supported you, encouraged you, held your hand at some points. And so since we know that higher levels of challenge and support are what enable growth, the DDOs, the deliberate part of DDOs says, well, why don't we go beyond happy accidents for people? Why don't we try to create an organizational environment where people experience higher levels of challenge and support every day?
So a light bulb just went off for me. So I'm reading some of the examples in the book, and I forget which of the three organizations did this so regularly. But the concept was, as soon as you've got your job down and you're comfortable, you're being moved on. And I thought, damn, shit, I just figured this out. Don't move me now.
That's right.
6 months. But you don't get that. And now, so your explanation here of the value of the happy accident, make it deliberate. Put the individual, and all of us are highly capable, or we wouldn't take on these challenges, put the individual in this situation where that, quote, happy accident happens more frequently, because you're forced to the growth edge, you're supported, and then greater things happen. Now I understand why they do that.
Yeah, yep, exactly right. And the idea is that you not only want to stretch individuals, but you want individuals to be part of a unit, or as some of the companies call them, a container that itself is being stretched. So the idea is that you want to have folks be part of a team that when they when sort of the goal emerges for that team for the coming year, there's a moment where they look at each other and say, wow, we have no idea how we're going to achieve that goal. We're going to have to rethink everything. And a DDO wants to have those kind of conversations happening. It wants to have people questioning the way they've done things before and questioning, even more importantly, the old assumptions that underlie the way that they've done things before, both collectively in terms of a team or a unit or a whole organization, but also individually. And that actually leads, we didn't exactly plan it this way, Andy, but that actually leads to the notion of what the heck do we mean by development?
Right.
And what we mean by development, kind of our sort of, I'll call it a semi-formal definition of development, is surfacing, so bringing to the surface, engaging or testing, and then ultimately transcending limiting assumptions and the behavioral patterns associated with them. So by limiting assumptions, we just mean old ways of thinking, old assumptions that we might have unconsciously made about ourselves, about other people, about customers, markets.
About everything.
About everything.
It's moving to the left side of the Kinefin framework where best practices don't exist and you let go of what you think really worked and you have to let go of so many cognitive biases and go explore. Now, I'm sitting here thinking, what kind of organization can take this? And classical, hierarchical, Tayloristic, let's stack rank everybody. This shit's not going to fly. So it takes a much different mindset and organizational approach to even begin to think of this.
Yeah, it does. And it's interesting, though, the three that we profile in the book, all very different kinds of organizations. But they didn't start out necessarily to create what we came to label a DDO. And it was only, you know, it's kind of our labeling of them as DDOs is a recent phenomenon. They were actually trying to figure out the best way to run their business. And they independently came to the conclusion that the best way to run their business was by stimulating the growth and development of everybody who works in the business.
Right.
So it doesn't, you don't have to be a kind of organizational development or psychological kind of savant to be interested in this. That it's often kind of the, you know, quote unquote, hard-headed business people. Once you help them sort of get a hold of the concept, that they actually become the biggest converts to this idea because they see results.
And the other piece that always fascinates me is none of these organizations really knew what the other ones were doing. They were it's similar to, you know, what Brian Robertson found when he was looking at some of the institutions and Frederick Laloux and all these people. They did these research and they're just like, there's these common principles underlying these things that produce these vastly different organizational structures and performances and industries, yet there's some common ground.
Yeah, no, you're exactly right. And that was part of the fun for us in doing the research and writing the book was to see underlying these companies that were common principles and kind of common dimensions that we label in the book as edge, sort of the challenge side of development, home, which is more the support side of development, and then what we call groove, which is the regular practices of development. And it's groove that ultimately is what puts the deliberate into deliberately developmental. And each of these three companies have very different kinds of practices, but they're all in one form or another. They're all about a combination of best thing to do for running our business and simultaneously growing our people.
So many of our listeners are in the Agile space, and almost all of them are familiar with the four guiding principles of modern Agile. And there's an incredible synchronicity here. Make people awesome. Make safety a prerequisite. Experiment, learn rapidly, and deliver value. I hear a lot of congruence.
Absolutely. In our earlier exchange, you'd mentioned that one of the principles is at regular intervals, the team reflects on how to become more effective, tunes and adjusts its behavior accordingly.
Yes.
That's very much a part of the DDO mentality and set of practices built around that. What I think the contribution that we would have to make, and it's funny, we've just in the last 6 or 8 months begun working with a global financial services company that's going Agile. All 50,000 people in the company are converting over to an Agile way of working. But they wanted to inject what we would call developmental nutrients into their Agile process. And so we've had a lot of fun working with them and see incredible similarities. The thing that I think we contribute to it is this notion that it's one thing to work on improving processes, and a part of growing and both individually and collectively is when we think together about improving the way we work. That's often a growth experience. But it's another thing to work on the people who are doing the processes and work on the internal processes that are going on inside of those people. The internal processes that produce old assumptions, unconscious assumptions that are, unexamined. And if we can surface those, if we can use our work environment and the projects and the work that we're doing every day as the occasion to help us surface those unconscious assumptions, those limiting assumptions, and then do something with them, then not only are we improving the processes, the external processes by which we work, we're also improving the internal processes of the people who are doing the work.
Which creates then this wonderful feedback loop for both.
Exactly.
When you give meaning to people's lives and you make it safe to show up, the outcomes and the outputs align with the bigger vision. I'm curious with the three companies that you dove into, what were the roles of managers and leaders in those types of organizations with this type of deliberate mindset?
Yeah, it's interesting. They do, a lot of what they do, you would still recognize, in the context of a more traditional organization. So, they're still planning and strategizing and so forth. But in broad strokes, I'd say there's three big differences that you come to see is that there's an intense focus on pushing responsibility and authority down in the organization. And so you see leaders, more senior leaders, able and freed up to operate at a much more strategic level, at the level of strategy, at the level of principles than you may see in a typical organization, because they've pushed a lot of the day-to-day responsibilities and day-to-day authorities down further in the organization as part of the developmental edges for people. One of the companies that we studied, Decurion, based out on the West Coast, several different businesses, including movie theaters, real estate, et cetera. They have an axiom that says people are 10 times more capable than we think they are. And so when they think about, delegating, when they think about how work is going to get done, their mindset is, let's take into account that people are a lot more capable than we think they are, and they can handle more. So the one thing you see is that the work has gotten, pushed further and further down in these organizations. Then the other kind of second and third things you see is that the senior execs that I've seen operate with high levels of facilitative skills. So when they run meetings, the meetings don't just happen in a haphazard kind of way where, you know, the loudest voice or the most dominant personality or the person who's highest up on the org chart dominates the conversation.
Yeah, the hippo.
That's right. That's right. That the senior leaders actually see more of their role as facilitating the dialogue, the meeting, or enabling others to facilitate it, to make sure that everyone's voice gets heard, the issues are fully vetted, that assumptions are challenged, that we've thought about the issue from multiple perspectives. Which is a, you know, is a indicative of operating at kind of a higher level of development, is to regularly practice putting yourself in other people's shoes, and in the course of a business initiative, looking at, well, how would this affect other people? How are they going to be looking at this? And then the third thing, in addition to pushing work down in the kind of facilitative dimension, you also see a higher degree of time spent in a kind of coach sort of role. And so you see these senior executives having really often kind of consultant level capabilities in terms of coaching folks, drawing forth from people, you know, the best that they have, helping them solve problems, et cetera.
You talk about pushing responsibility down, down, down to the lowest point, and I'm reminded of a conversation we had on a podcast a couple of weeks ago with David Marquet, author of Turn This Ship Around, and he had a wonderful phrase, said he wasn't there to empower his people, he was there to emancipate. As the ship, as the captain of a nuclear submarine, he was there to emancipate and bring out that 10X factor of his crew that he knew was there. But the old systems were inhibiting.
Yeah, yeah. It's really, that's a great way to think about it. Back to Decurion, one of their other axioms is that they tell people to assume that management is unintentionally holding them back,
right,
and that they have full permission to push up against barriers that they may see that are in fact holding them back. And one of the concepts that kind of names some of the dynamic that we're talking about is the idea of liberating structures. Certain practices and processes can actually serve to liberate people rather than typically when we think about processes and systems, we think about, you know, that's all about boundaries and, you know, rules and guidelines. But in the DDOs, they're aiming for liberating structures that regularly bring forth more and more of people's full capabilities.
You talk about structures. Also in the book, you're pretty clear, and I think most of us who are in the transformation business and the coaching business, there is no playbook. There's no 10-step checklist for doing any of this or starting a DDO. However, for some teams that want to take the first steps or organization, what are some of the essential things? Liberating structures is one. You talked about edge, home, and groove. There's a few other things. How do we get started on the journey?
Yeah, I'll just ground this in some work that we're doing with a company right now, where the CEO, it's about a 300-person company, CEO took an interest after reading the book and actually did a little book club with his senior managers, which, you know, we'd love to hear when he told us about this. And it started with some individual coaching for him. But what quickly it quickly evolved toward that they the senior management team you know, came to believe, reading the book and in some conversations with us, came to believe that if they were going to make this sort of a part of the whole culture and not just something that existed in small pockets, that they themselves would need to become a kind of developmental community for each other. And in the course of doing that, would learn what it would take to spread that across the organization and also then would be credible role models and champions for this in the broader company. So one way to get started, we've created a process that we call your agile folks might like this. We call it a developmental sprint. So it's having a small, it can be as small a group as, three people, or it could be, a team or a unit and could eventually be the whole company. But actually for a bounded period of time, everyone works on their own particular improvement goal and an improvement goal that would also have benefit for the company as well. And then we put some protocols and practices and frameworks around that enable people in the context of their regular work to be doing experiments that test big assumptions, limiting assumptions around their particular improvement goal and support each other as they're doing it. So that in a relatively short period of time, like 4 to 6 weeks, people can actually get an experience of what it's like to operate in a deliberately developmental way. And then it's possible then to have a different kind of conversation with them and for them to have a different kind of conversation among themselves once they've actually tasted it.
Right.
There's in chapter 7 of the book, we talk a bit about that. So if someone just wanted to, sort of draw from the book, we talk a little bit about how you can kind of start with a small unit or team to get a taste of this yourself. And that's what I would encourage more than anything, whether you're the CEO or whether you're just a team leader, somewhere in the middle of an organization, is that you need to sort of take it on for yourself. And if you can't find any support among other people, likely you can find at least one other person and become developmental buddies for each other. And there's some practices in the book that we talk about that you could take on with that.
You can do it as small as a pair.
Absolutely.
You can do it with a pilot team.
That's
top
right.
Down. You talk in the book about, middle out or bottom up.
Yeah.
And it's a very same pattern that transformation takes place at almost any scale, particularly at an enterprise scale. If you try to change the course of the Queen Mary quickly, it just doesn't go well.
No, that's what we found. Yeah.
So you talk about a personal goal on this pilot team, and that's the edge of the Edge Home Groove Trinity. Let's talk about all those pieces. So the edge is that growth edge from comfort to stretch, and hopefully not all the way to panic. A personal goal, a self-improvement issue that is made of team knowledge. Right. You're not hiding anything
that's exactly
anymore. And then what's the aspect of home and groove in this?
As it relates to this kind of practice, the home aspect, in part, you just mentioned it. It's actually being public with an improvement goal. It's saying, this is something that I want to get better at. I don't think I have it all. I don't think I have it all down. And it's having a group of people who are kind of like your crew that you invite to observe you, you invite to give you feedback, and you share with them the experiments that you're doing on behalf of the assumptions that you're testing and the improvement goal that you're working on, and sort of share with them warts and all what's happened when you've done those experiments, how you're making sense of those experiments, what impact are they having on your big assumptions, and invite them to offer their interpretations as well, to challenge your thinking about it. So I'm just going to digress here just for one second, Andy, just to say one of the things that if I had to put in a nutshell what accelerates development for individuals and then what can have a cascading effect in an organization is that if you develop the capacity to think about your thinking.
Mm.
So if you develop the capacity to, as we talked about earlier, bring to the surface and actually see your big assumptions, see how often you default to assumptions about everything, and then begin to see the patterns, your own particular patterns of those assumptions, then that gives you the ability to actually in a sense, apply the principles of the scientific method to your own development. It gives you the chance to test, run little tests of those big assumptions and see, gee, if I'm trying to get better at delegating and I have this big assumption, didn't realize I had it, but I actually have this assumption that, gee, no matter what I delegate, they're going to screw it up. Well, that's an assumption that is something that you can test, and you can test it in different ways. And if you have the support, the home side of things that we're talking about, they can challenge you and help you and hold you accountable for doing those kind of tests.
I think it's scarier than that, Andy. So you've got your home crew, you've got your edge. You've said, guys, this part of my game needs some work. And you might not even know where it needs work. And you have invited your crew to be radically candid and truthful with you. That's got to smart sometimes when you see that. When you're like, no, I can't tell it. Yes, you can. When someone says, there you go again, you know, you're not questioning your beliefs and your thoughts. Wow, you really got to show up with some humility and some vulnerability.
Well, and that's the home dimension. And it becomes a lot easier to do that in organizations more broadly when you see the CEO and senior executives and leadership all down the line doing it. So one of the things we offer to clients is we have a what we call a growth culture indicator. It's an organizational survey tool that gives people a kind of MRI in terms of the extent to which they already have a growth culture in their organization, or they lack a growth culture in their organization. And one of the items in the growth culture indicator is under a subcategory that we call leader vulnerability. And that's a subcategory within the home concept. And what we found is that to the extent that leaders themselves operate vulnerably, that has an enormous impact on the level of vulnerability in the rest of the organization. So one of the items on the survey is, to what extent do senior leaders in your organization acknowledge what they may have contributed to problems?
That is a huge freaking question.
Yes.
Yes. And it's got to be, as you guys, you know, if you do this pre-survey before an engagement, it might change the price by orders of magnitude, depending on the answer. Because, you know, so many people get to that level because what they've done works, and they've been the hero with all the answers. And it is a complete mindset
change.
I was going to say, I was going to use the F word.
Yeah.
But, you know, we're on iTunes. I don't know if we get flagged on that or not. But it is such a turn. How does a leader begin to let go of all the decades of beliefs? I guess it's with the home crew.
It's with the home crew.
It's a joint commitment that says we're all in this together, and we're calling each other out, and we've given each other permission.
That's right. And if you – so two thoughts on that, Andy. If you're the only one in an organization who's doing that, that's one thing that requires, you know, much greater degrees of courage. But if everyone else is doing it, you know, and you see that you're part of you see it both writ large, but you also experience it in a crew, you know, that's local to you, that you regularly engage with, you see it with them, then it becomes less of a heroic act. And if there are practices and protocols that reinforce this and kind of keep you on the pathway, so it becomes less of an event when you actually are vulnerable and share, hey, I think I messed this up. And actually you experience that people are encouraged and there's practices to facilitate that all the time.
What are some of those practices?
Sure.
Can you share an example? What does it sound like?
I'll give you a couple of examples. So one in one of the companies we looked at, Bridgewater, that, you know, is the world's largest operator of hedge funds and been incredibly successful at it. They have teams and units. They keep mistake logs or issue logs. And really the only unpardonable sin is not logging in your mistakes. And they regularly open open up the log and walk through the mistakes with a certain kind of protocol around doing that, so that it's not a beat up session or a blame session. It's a let's understand what assumptions we made that led us down a path that, you know, we'd not like to go down again. So a mistake log is one example of a practice or a protocol. I'll draw from the military, and this is not in the book, but in the course of doing the research for the book, we had a chance to talk to some different folks in the military, and I got to talk to some folks in the Blue Angels, that air demonstration folks that are mostly naval flyers, and the six pilots who make up the Blue Angels. After every time they fly, whether it's for a practice and they're working on their routines, or whether it's actually doing a routine, afterwards they come into a room, and there's other people there, and there's a lot of data and technology that supports their examination of how they did, what they did, et cetera. But the debriefing, the heart of it, starts with the boss pilot, who says, "Here's what I saw out there today. Here's what I think we did well. Here's what I think we didn't do so well. And here's what I think I contributed to the problems."
Wow.
And then it goes around the table and everybody shares along those lines. And the conversation starts from there. Another guy from the military, who was a squadron leader in Afghanistan, told me that, he said, "Look, I was over there leading a squadron. We were doing flights, missions, and we'd gotten into a rhythm of plan, execute the mission, rest, plan, execute the mission." And he said, we were having some success and achieving our mission, but we weren't getting better. And he said, out of an effort to try to sort of break through that, he said, just given the way the rhythms of our particular time there, at midnight every night, I would call a meeting with the whole squad there. And I'd start off the meeting by saying, "Here's all the mistakes that I think I made today." And that was the start of the meeting. And that broke the ice and encouraged other people to be reflective and look at what they didn't do so well. And then it opened up conversations about how we could do it better. So when that sort of thing is happening as a matter of routine, when it's, as to use our expression in the book, when it's grooved into the organization and everyone is participating in that, it takes less courage to be vulnerable. It takes less courage to give feedback, too. In most organizations, when, the idea of giving feedback, heck, they only do it twice a year at best. And, they have to screw up their courage for a long time before they do it. In a DDO or in a growth culture, it's just not that way. It's just a much more sort of regular kind of circumstance, and it's less of a heroic act.
That's a beautiful loop back to the 12th principle of the Agile Manifesto at regular intervals. What you said earlier, the team reflects on how to become more effective,
yep,
and then tunes and adjusts its behavior accordingly. And you add the twist that whoever's the perceived leader kicks off and doesn't say, "Okay, how did all you guys do up?" It starts with, "Here's how I can improve." And it's blameless. That's
right.
Such a powerful practice.
Yep. I really do like the language. Here's what I think I contributed to the problems. And then it would flow from there. If they were really on top of it, they'd say, "And here's how that might be connected to a pattern that I've noticed. And here's what I intend to do about it. And here's how I need your help."
Yeah, and that's a big piece. That's the big piece of the container
that's
you
right.
talked about. That home crew that says, "My mask is off. I see this. My backhand here is weak. I need you guys to keep serving it there."
Yeah, and also when you see me hit a good backhand, let me know. So it's not all about just pointing out, a person's limitations or flaws. It's also celebrating when they make some progress, when they hit that good topspin cross-court backhand. It's saying, "Look, I see you. I saw what you did." And maybe even explore a little bit. "Let's look at how you did that one, because that was a great shot."
I think that's a beautiful point. So what are some of the practices or protocols that you've seen in your travels that celebrate that? Because you're right. Oftentimes we focus on where we screwed up and how we can get better rather than the nine things we did great.
Yeah, actually, I've seen it lots of different approaches to this. I've seen it where at the beginning of staff meetings, at the beginning of, you know, all hands meetings in companies. I've seen it at the end of a week. One of the companies we work with in the book, I mentioned Next Jump, an e-commerce company. At the end of every week, they don't have, you know, what was the, whatever the sort of stereotypical kind of beer blast, you know, from perhaps days gone by. In technology companies, but they have a little practice where they gather and people take the time to single out someone who particularly lived the company's values during that week, or who made an extraordinary contribution to a business issue that week, or even more, somebody who enabled somebody else to make a contribution.
Right.
So at Next Jump, they talk about, you know, we want to recognize not just the quarterback, so to speak, and the running back or the wide receivers who get all the glory. We want to recognize the people on the line, you know, who are doing the blocking.
Right. They created the space for the quarterback to have the time to find the open receiver who had the time to run.
Exactly right. And so they have a kind of groove around recognizing those folks. They do it in an informal way every Friday, but they also do it regularly, monthly, a crowdsourced way of lifting up a number of folks who have made those kind of contributions, and then recognize annually the folks who have been, you know, sort of the best linemen, so to speak, across the company. So
not solely as an individual contributor, but for the goal of
that's
the
right.
team.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because it puts it in that context of the collective us.
Yep, that's right. Their motto at Next Jump, it sounds simple, but it's not simplistic. But their motto is better me plus better you equals better us. And the commitment is that we're going to help each other become better me's and better you's in order to make for a better us.
That's a great place to wrap up. We're coming at the end of a wonderful hour. I feel like we could do a couple more of these talks. I want to thank you for your time and give you a few moments to shout out things that you're involved in, as well as include a way for listeners to get in touch with you so that they can continue the conversation.
Sure. So we're on social media, Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, Way to Grow Inc., WayToGrowInc. Those are ways to reach us or just to stay connected with us. If there was something in anything that I may have shared that folks might have an interest in exploring or pursuing further, can reach us that through one of those means, or on our website at waytogrowinc.com. We'll have some likely have some more public workshops coming up later in the year and in future years, and we'll certainly be publicizing those through those means.
That's great. So you're also, before the show, we were talking about you're down in Atlanta and you're associated with Georgia Tech. Tell us more about some of the programs that you're working with.
There's a really interesting entity at Georgia Tech called Flashpoint at Georgia Tech that it's kind of a incubator / accelerator, not just for startups, but also for kind of new product groups and innovation groups within larger organizations, run by a really brilliant professor there by the name of Merrick First, who's also an entrepreneur and been in the startup world for a long time. But I help support their cohort groups that go through the program and bring some of the DDO ideas and concepts that they've actually now incorporated, not only into helping the startups and the organizations run more according to kind of growth culture principles, but actually apply some of the insights from that into the way they interact with customers and, in fact, do customer discovery as well. So that's a pretty cool thing that folks, if any of that sparks any interest at all, they ought to check that out at Flashpoint at Georgia Tech.
Yep, I'll make sure to get links in the show notes to all that stuff. And it's certainly better to start at the beginning than to try to turn your Queen Mary.
That's right. 50
or 100,000 people later. Well, thanks again, Andy Fleming. It's been a pleasure talking to you. Listening audience, if you enjoyed this episode, give us a review on your podcast listening platform of the choice. It really helps others find us. If this is your first time tuning in, subscribe. You'll catch the next one automatically. And if you'd like to join the discussion, share your stories about how you're nailing your backhand topspin return, please join us at coalitionagileuprising.com. And one more thing, support from listeners like you help us cover our hosting and podcast costs. See the show notes for how you become a patron. Until next time, this is Andy Kleff for the Agile Uprising Podcast, signing out.